We're still missing Bennett, who's, I don't know where he is. He's just in the desert being a lizard, I guess. But we don't miss him. All right, David, what are we talking about?
So Donald Trump.
No, we miss you, Bennett. Please keep being our editor.
Come back, Bennett. We miss you. Am I even on?
That's what I meant. What?
I don't have a camera lens or a camera. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Joe. Yeah. He's like, you just keyed in yourself. Yeah, didn't even look at my camera. I look up and it's pointed at the ceiling with the lens cap on.
It's not on there at all.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are so glad to be with you. We've got all three of us at the same table for the first time.
Yeah!
In months.
We're together.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Good to see you guys.
Yeah, it's good to see you too.
Yeah, looking into your steely blue eyes. It's nice.
Are they steely?
I don't know.
Are they blue?
Would you like it if I said soft blue eyes? Would that be better?
Prefer rigid? Fully torqued?
Stiff blue eyes? Okay,
anyways. Yeah. Good to be back. We're still missing Bennett. Of course, Bennett, we miss you very much. Never forget it.
Yeah.
Never forget.
Come back to us.
Come back to us. He's just out there doing his thing, living his best life. And we love that journey for him.
We love that for him.
God, this episode got really bitchy all of a sudden.
Hey, man, we're trying to broaden our audience, you know, appeal to new demographics.
Yeah.
Well, 100%. When do we incorporate that technology you were showing us with the clip
that turns you into a girl?
Yeah.
We should experiment.
We should.
We could.
It's not too late for International Women's Month, right?
That would be a great episode. First day of International Women's Month.
I think it's Big Potato Month right now, right?
Right now. Oh, that's
still
right.
Big Potato Month.
Irish American.
And International Women's Month. Is it both?
And Scuttlebutt Conor McGregor's running for president of Ireland.
I did see that.
Yeah.
Dang.
He kind of said it on Twitter without saying it on Twitter.
Big Potato up.
Yeah.
Big Potato. Stocks are rising.
Heck yeah.
Big Potato is controlling this country.
To the moon. Yeah, you think you know who killed JFK. Well, it was Big Potato. We're going to tell you right now.
He is Big Potato.
We're going to spoil.
that was a blow against Big Potato.
That's can't get much more potato than Kennedy, can you?
Exactly.
He's a potato traitor.
Irish Catholic.
What are we talking about today?
That's a great question.
So Donald Trump is ending the Department of Education. And we have even more JFK assassination documents to analyze and cover. So the kids better learn to read while they can, because we're getting into old-timey spy stuff.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love
Let's
it.
Let's go.
Yeah. And to kick this off, we have... Well, before we kick it off, make sure to like and subscribe and do all the YouTube things, the Spotify things, whatever you're listening to us. Leave a review. Do the stuff.
Choose your favorite thing and just do that one thing.
Do that thing.
Yeah.
Do one thing. Yeah. Help us spread this podcast. We need the support. We're a growing podcast, but we need you to help us promote it. It's really viewer-to-viewer promotion that makes the difference. So.
That's right. That's
and become a member, where we have a members-only show. And today we're going to be talking a bunch about... there was an interesting Ezra Klein talking mm-hmm. about where the Democrats failed, and we're going to pick it apart.
Yeah. It's going to be fun.
Where do we start?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Their perspective on
what... is much different than ours.
Very interesting. And it's where it converges is interesting, where it departs is interesting. So check it out.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Yeah, right. So getting into the Department of Education here, we have Elon posted a meme. He's the meme of the week for us this time. It's Donald Trump over the grave, giving the peace sign of the Department of Education.
Department.
you'll notice that it was misspelled. I don't know if that was purposeful or not.
That could be a slight knock against American education.
But and then we also have there was this that came out too, where
Louis Nana. We have
Louisiana.
Louis Nana.
We have what looks to be a projection of a light, a seal, an emblem on a curtain here, and it's spelled Supreme Court of the State of Louis Nana.
So this 5 million viewed tweet was Speaker Mike Johnson from the great state of Louisiana. Louisiana wants to get rid of the Department of Education. Now the irony here is this is a criticism of how dumb they are, but at the same time, and this was what Marvin Rummers is like, you realize the Department of Education is operating now, so if we can't read now, it obviously means something has failed.
Maybe a correlation.
Or can't spell anyways.
Yes.
So let's get into just a quick bit, for the moment in history here. We'll take a quick look at Trump's speech on getting rid of the Department of Education, and then we'll kind of talk about our projections and our thoughts about it here.
Today we take a very historic action that was 45 years in the making. In a few moments, I will sign an executive order to begin eliminating the federal Department of Education once and for all.
You.
That's one of my favorite Trump hand gestures, yeah, is I see you. It's like moderately feminine too.
That's what I was saying, and it's like a very hey, you know, kind of thing. I don't
remember when this was during the campaign. It was kind of in the last few months. There was that video going around. It was like 7 seconds, and it had the "Do you ever feel like somebody's watching you?" song. Yeah, and then it's Trump just kind of like looking into the crowd, and then he turns, looks at the camera, and goes,
"Gotcha." Oh, the memes are good.
So,
What's this executive order all about?
So basically, the executive order, it is giving the authority to McMahon, which is the wife of Vince McMahon, who is the...
I believe it's pronounced McMahon.
McMahon. It's spelled Mahan.
Yeah, it is.
Which, but...
Also potato, McMahon, by the way. Actually, probably a little more...
super potato.
Haggis, I guess. Big haggis.
Big haggis.
I don't know if you can say that.
That's fair. She's not a haggis.
I can say it. Big haggis.
I was thinking back to a conversation that happened a year ago about that being anti-Semitic.
Haggis? Hag.
No.
Haggis, it's different.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's similar, you know? It's like, I don't know what the rules are anymore.
There are no rules.
It is a hate that mutates, so you don't know where you're at with that at any given time.
I'm sure we'll find out.
Best just not to talk about
it. So it gives the Secretary of Education the authority and the order to begin the dismantling process of the Department of Education, everything within her own legal bounds. Mm. That and it specifically says in the order to begin and start focusing on everything DEI related, or like gender ideology and all of that stuff. So it's kind of ordering the abolishing of the Department of Education, but it's not explicitly saying necessarily the abolishment of the Department of Education, because that does require an act from Congress, gotcha, and Senate, and all the votes and stuff to go for it.
So does the DEI stuff, is that manifesting as, you know, obviously Trump has already talked about removing federal funding from schools who are implementing DEI programs. Is that like dismantling that or dismantling it within the Department of Education specifically?
Yeah, that's actually in the order somewhere, if I remember right. There is a talk about the funds. It starts talking about the Department of Education currently manages a student loan debt portfolio for more than $1.6 trillion, which, wow. It begins comparing it to being like a bank. And it's like, the Department of Education is not a bank. And it's talking about the moving of the funds. It's talking about the necessities of bringing the education back to the states, making it more local. It kind of has all that verbiage in there.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. How much do you think she's going to be able to get done before it does require Congress to act here?
Well, the question is, how much can she reduce staff, automate, make things smaller or more efficient? That's ultimately probably the net outcome, right? And then eliminating programs that aren't serving this and then delegating those programs to the state. So the classic model of this is what they call block grants, where you say, rather than implementing programs from DC, we're going to just give you cash for programs and then you implement them. and kind of delegating that to the states. I assume that's the direction, given the framing that they're using of returning this to schools and localities and states.
Yeah. I would say, you know, one of the major pushbacks to this would be, oh, you know, education is going to go downhill because, you know, we're not, the Department of Education is less strong. That would maybe be the predominant argument from the left. You've done a lot of work around education and, you know, local education, charter schools, things like that. What is your view of what impact this will have on education?
So the federal government's giving to particular school districts is a relatively small amount of most schools' budgets, right? There are some schools that are more reliant on than others. But a lot of those things, when you look at those, you dive deeper into it, a lot of those are like very rural native schools, places like that. And I don't see these really being impactful for them. They're not ending the pipeline completely for money. And you know, what will be the net outcome? Well, the connection between money spending and educational outcome is very weak, right? As those numbers do not correlate. What tends to correlate best is, you know, there's that on the local level that does correlate sometimes, but oftentimes those are multivariable, right? You have someone from a community that values education, you're going to get more focus on education, more accountability for teachers and things like that. When other communities, usually lower income, don't have the same value of education, not only will they bring in less property tax dollars, therefore, to your local school, which is part of the challenge of funding schools rather than students. For the families that do care about education that are in that low-income area, they're more likely to be in the toughest situation, right? They're the ones that would take a school choice program if they could get access to one.
And then lastly, the
explosion in funding that we have in education is now going to teachers.
Yeah, like it's administration, right?
Administrative hiring is exploded with the additional funds.
Yeah, you talk about the lack of correlation. I think we've all seen the chart of the two lines. It's like administrative spending is just up and to the right, and at a certain point, student outcomes, educational outcomes, just start tapering off over the course of the last, I don't know, 10 or 20 years.
Well, at least not improving. And then when you look at the national outcomes, right, that's where the story is the clearest, where we spend more on education than ever and our returns are weakest than ever. We still produce, you know, some of the greatest students in the world, some of the smartest, brightest people. That's the upper end of that echelon still is great in American education. The question is are we moving the bottom and the middle to the right?
Right.
And that is in areas where they do implement funding students, backpack funding, you know, rather than funding schools, those outcomes do tend to get better. So the degree to which this will feed into that, you know, that's a question. They've floated a lot of ideas about education choice from the federal government, but are they really going to get to that place with this? That's a lot of administrative burden. Right. So if they're trying to reduce administrative burden, that kind of runs counter to that because you have to vet what are they spending money on, who are the students, all that kind of stuff. That takes FTEs. That takes time and employment time.
What's FTEs?
Full-time equivalent employment. Right. Gotcha. So like that means you're hiring someone to administrate that program. And then, you know, how many people do you need depending on how many students you have enter the program? And I would guess that would also take an act of Congress because that would be a pretty substantial departure from the Department of Education's traditional statutory authority.
Do you expect Congress to act on this?
No, they can't get through the Senate, right? There's not enough Republican votes in the Senate.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's a good budget. It's a good photo op. It's a good message. It's something that does distract from a lot of the other things that the Trump administration's doing, right? That, you know, like trade wars and things like that aren't the fall part of peace in Gaza, you know, it's a good message, but I'm not sure. It's waits to be seen. The other part of that I think is interesting is the degree to which the Democrats don't see what he does. They just react to what he says. So he says, we're ending the Department of Education. Like, you can't do that, right? They're just reacting to that. So it keeps them on their back foot, reacting to something he's not doing.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of a feint, if you will.
Well, that being said, is the legislation has been introduced by Thomas Massie in Congress and Rand Paul in the Senate, which is for the abolishing, because this is the part that requires an act from Congress. Because one of the things, because I'm seeing two major critiques coming on this whole thing right now. One is the Democrats saying Trump hates the kids and we're trying to like make our kids less educated or something. Like, we can ignore that. That doesn't even really matter.
It's a huge part of making America great again is dumbing down the kids.
But then I'm seeing a lot of, and this is actually what I'm seeing, this is more so from like Trump's enemies within the right, kind of. I'm seeing a much more talk about procedural stuff, where it's like, well, Trump can't do this because it can't be an executive order because it was signed into Congress and all this stuff. But it's just like, clearly, like one, you didn't read the executive order. I can see that already. You didn't read the executive order. And there is accompanying legislation that's coming through, which is what is required for the actual abolishing of the Department of Education. Yeah. Yeah. I have the tweet from Thomas Massey. He has a list of 32 co-sponsors on his effort to abolish the Department of Education. Thomas Massey puts this in every year, actually. Yeah. This is just like the first time it's actually going to have traction because of the weight of Trump. And then Rand Paul saying, my father introduced legislation to eliminate the Department of Education in the early 1980s. Rep Massey continued the same bill, one sentence, and I've introduced the Senate version. Thanks to President Trump for working to return education to the states, right?
Yeah. So the question is, can they get this into a reconciliation or something like that with another bill as a writer? I don't know. The feds have a very weak germane law rule, so like meaning you can put things together that don't make any sense.
Yeah.
Some states have those kind of weak rules, and they can just throw something into a budget bill that changes the Department of Education. But will they be able to get that through the Senate? Will Senate Democrats, you know, stop it? I think it's a low likelihood that the legislation actually happens. My guesstimate.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that downer, David.
Well, although that being said,
we're probably going to be seeing pretty big scalebacks from what is within the executive authority,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't get through this go around, doesn't mean it's not going to go through in future years. Like this might be something that gains a lot of momentum, right?
That's a fair point. I mean, if they're able to scale it back to the point where it's minimally effective and minimally costly at the federal level, mm-hmm. states are able to take education back over, at least the lion's share of it. And we don't see education outcomes drop substantially or perhaps maybe even improve, then maybe it shifts the Overton window for a subsequent administration to actually say, see, we have results here. This isn't the time bomb we thought it would be.
I would suspect a lot of the game theory that is actually being had right now is like in the executive order, it said it's clearly it's targeting very specific things that it's like it's deeming illegal at this point, which is like discrimination via the law through these DEI programs and gender ideology and all this stuff. Like, and that it explicitly says that. It says that the Secretary of Education's duty right now is to eliminate all funding for any programs that are violating the law. And it specifically labels those out as the things that they're focusing on.
Gotcha.
So there's going to be a lot of that to be had. And who knows, once you get Doge in there and once you get like, you know, who knows where that starts to go?
Yeah.
That might be a thing that proves to the American people of like, yeah, the federal programs here are kind of problematic.
Yeah.
And actually, I have a clip here from Ronald Reagan who wanted to abolish the Department of Education. And bearing in mind, it was just the previous president that started it. It was Jimmy Carter that it came under. So you had Ronald Reagan talking about this on the campaign trail and during his presidency of him wanting to do it. So let me play that clip here.
I propose and would have already started, if your hypothesis is correct, a planned and orderly transfer back to the states and local communities of functions the federal government has usurped and which it has proven it is incapable of operating. And one of the first of those would be welfare. One of the second would be in the field of education. I would like to dissolve the $10 billion National Department of Education created by President Carter and turn schools back to the local school districts where we built the greatest public school system the world has ever seen. I think I can make a case that the decline in the quality of public education began when federal aid became federal interference.
Hmm. Great communicator. Yeah.
Quite true. Very eloquent.
I'm very curious about what the, you know, so especially what are going to be the aesthetics, right? So when the Democrats vote against this, are people going to be like, oh, this is Democrats fighting for the good institutions, you know? Or is it going to be Democrats aren't in reality, this institution isn't helping anything? Is that the general impression of the public? Now, the public does tend to trust Democrats on education, right? There's still the myth that, you know, the more money we spend, the better education we get, despite the graphs and the numbers and how systematic it's been for three decades now. That's not true.
Well, yeah, and worth noting, too, he mentions the $10 billion a year Department of Education. The number pulled up is about, $267.9 billion.
Wow.
So a lot more money and not a lot of results from this one.
Yeah. I would be curious on actual public sentiment at this point in time, especially after we've had the last few years. Like, the American common view of education as a whole has drastically shifted since COVID.
Yeah.
Like, just because they kind of saw how their kids were being taught during the COVID times, but then also how much the woke ideology stuff has really just become mainstream of, like, everybody kind of knows about it at this point.
Yeah.
I would be curious on what actual public sentiment is. And I was actually just punching that into Grok to see if there's anything I could pull here. But yeah, but it's also just kind of going back to the Reagan thing too, is how difficult it was for him to actually be able to accomplish this kind of shows how deeply entrenched the teachers unions and all of those entrenched entities really got their grips into this thing in a very short period of time.
Yeah. One dynamic to that has changed substantially is after a decision from the United States Supreme Court basically implemented right to work for all public sector employees, especially teachers unions. So I can't remember what the court name decision was, but it effectively implement that nationwide. So with their reduced power and ability to organize, you know, there has been a drop in the unions from that, because people were opting out. They're like, hey, you're not benefiting me, so I'm going to drop out of the union, or on ideological grounds for the most part. That there's a, you know, good question about whether or not now's the time, because they're relatively weaker.
Yeah. Yeah, Kyle, I was able to pull up some polling data. It looks like it's actually not widely supported across this variety of polls that I pulled up here. Looks like about 55 to 60% of those polled oppose abolishing the Department of Education, and roughly 30%, 25 to 30% support it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually good.
Why do you say that?
Because I bet historically it's probably 80% opposed.
Fair.
That was exactly what I was thinking too, is that it feels like that's probably shifted a lot. And in general, the idea of sending education back to the states to varying degrees is a very right-wing issue. So, like, there's going to be a spectrum of belief that exists there where the radicals are abolish the Department of Education, but the radicals are becoming more and more the general, like, Republican platform now. And actually, like, just this being a thing here, it's like Trump is kind of making it the Republican platform to abolish it.
Right, and to be clear, Bush also said he'd abolish the Department of Education. Then he signed on to No Child Left Behind.
Right.
So, like, you know, so, like, it's a typical Republican football to hold out for Republican voters and then not do anything. But also, you have to have a substantial policy majority. You got to get 60 votes in the Senate to pass a bill to do that.
Right. It looks like, from what I was able to find, there's very limited polling data as far back as the 90s, but it looks like it might have moved towards supporting abolishing the Department of Education by about 5 to 10 points over that time. So not a ton, but some for sure.
Cool. Let's get into the JFK files, the spicy bits in the JFK files.
Oh, yeah.
So who killed him, guys? Just lay it out for me. Who killed him?
It was
aliens. The magic bullet.
It's the one I didn't have any money on.
It was a lone shooter.
No. Do you remember Dave Chappelle's Black President skits that he did back in the Bush era?
Yeah.
Those were the best. And he was like bringing them up. It was like, we cloned these two white women here. And then it's just like, they did kill JFK with a magic bullet. Yes, magic is real. And he just goes into space wizards.
It is funny that the magic bullet was the dominant theory and everybody's just like, yeah, that makes sense.
Sure.
Well, I mean, it's funny. When you look at public opinion polling, the amount of the American public is very skeptical of the Warren Commission examples. It's always been relatively low. It's been low since the 1970s. It's actually gotten stronger over time as people just kind of lost the plot. You know, as time goes by, right? People just be like, oh, I don't remember what happened with Kennedy.
Well, it's so old. Yeah. Who should care? Why should we care?
Exactly.
You know, that's a good point. And some very influential people are raising that point. Let's hear what Ben Shapiro had to say about that.
Sort of conspiracy theorizing that's become incredibly popular on the right these days. It was popular on the left, and now it's become increasingly popular on the right. The kind of, let's just ask questions. We'll ask, who really killed JFK? Wink, wink, nod, nod. And then you're like, well, do you have any evidence of the thing that you are presupposing? Well, no, I'm not making any accusations. I just know I don't believe the story that I'm being told. I know not to trust the authorities. You're like, well, that's fine. But do you have like any evidence, not just supposition? I said, well, you're part of it, aren't you? You're part of it. The reason that you're so defensive about all this is I don't care who killed JFK. I mean, I do because it's really interesting. But I noticed that the calendar says 2025 and he was killed in 1963. And so my opinion about who killed JFK has about as much relevance as who killed William McKinley, or James Garfield, which is to say not an enormous amount.
Those eyebrows really are authoritative, aren't they?
Guys, you stop asking questions, number one. We don't want any home research, right?
Certainly not.
And you definitely don't have evidence for anything you claim. But definitely. We just know you don't have evidence. There's no evidence that can exist because it can't.
Despite the, 120,000 documents that have just dropped this week, and we're only one third of the documents dropped so far.
Yeah, with only a few days to look at hundreds of thousands of pages. But there's no evidence. You're just blindly accusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is
you just don't believe the authorities. Just don't believe the authorities. That's his case. That's what we have. Hundreds of books being written over many decades about the case, about why the Warren Commission's case is weak, if not outright false and gerrymandered in order to come up with the conclusion that the powerful authorities wanted to have at the time. And you're just, what evidence do you have? You know, like you're like, I'm just blind man. Just say like, well, where is it? You know, it's just like,
I can't see it. Well, it doesn't exist.
This is the frustrating thing about this. And it's always the same types of influencers. Ben Shapiro is always one of those types. Every time there's like some major bombshell on anything that's like related into like semi-conspiracy stuff, that and where there's like, ooh, there's a bunch of new information that we should be looking at on this, that, or the other. Like, it's the same types of that always come, oh, who cares? It was 60 years ago. Or do you really think the government would be able to do something like that? You know, like, it's infuriating to see that all the time. To the point where it's like, are you covering something? Like, it makes you feel like that.
Just asking questions. Do you, I think one of you guys sent it to our chat, juxtaposing this statement against one of him talking very passionately about biblical history. Like, well, if the relevance of an issue is how long ago it was.
Very specifically, it was about the Holocaust.
Why? Yes, fair. Yeah.
But
biblical history in American mythology.
Well, biblical, what he's talking about is actually Israel and like why the Jews are the actual legitimate owners of Israel, right? Like the God is real estate agent argument, right? So yes, people really care about things that happened a long time ago. Duh. You know, and as if JFK was an inconsequential thing that happened, like James Garfield. Like James Garfield, that was important at its era. You can get a lot out of, okay, well, I did a whole bunch of world leaders get killed by anarchists very, very strangely at the particular turn of the century. Very strange question. You can look at it. Fascinating historical thing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, that's equivalent to the 1960s of a sitting American president almost reaching a peace agreement with Castro and Khrushchev. You know, that happened. And then all of a sudden, that was looking like it was going to happen. The American University speech happens. All these things start to go ahead in a particular direction. And then he dies. And then you're like, well, that's not important. Well, you know, that was a long time ago.
Well, it's also part of the reason why it's important is because actually one of the most interesting things about this is the newly unredacted things here are giving us more of a window into how CIA operations actually worked. Mm-hmm. Whether or not there was involvement that came in from the CIA or cliques within the CIA or whatever, mm-hmm. is like we are getting, we'll get into one of the things at the end of the episode. Actually, we found a very hilarious nugget about birds.
Yeah. they are real, sort of.
They are real, but they are spies. we will get into that at the end.
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler. But because that was an unredacted thing that came in here. But like we're seeing kind of how this works. But then we also have questions about things that have happened in more recent history, like the current sitting president did have some assassination attempts on him last year, and the lack of information is concerning and confusing. And maybe if we have better understanding of these things that happened with the Kennedys, maybe there's corollaries that exist there.
Are you telling me a gun runner into Ukraine, running around the world, recruiting for Ukraine,
Ryan Ralph,
which is a CIA operation, right? The New York Times told us this. Has nothing to do with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, getting visas for people in the Middle East, terrorists, you know, militant individuals in the Middle East and sending them to Ukraine.
Yeah.
Nothing to do
with
the State
Department.
And then
he just comes to the United States, no problem. You know, someone else also.
Who cares? He did that like 5 years ago.
yeah, it's like 5 whole years. So, and that patterns, right?
Actually, it was like 2 years ago.
Oswald goes to the USSR after serving in the US Army in Japan, doing signals intelligence in Japan, spying on the USSR. We have the documents to suggest that he, or they're public now. We have the documents. I got the documents.
We have the documents.
suggesting that he was offering these secrets to the USSR, comes back into the United States, and we don't do anything about it.
I'll
very
actually,
strange. And then the same pattern continues. Then he shoots the president. Weird.
Weird.
You know? I'll actually add to that too, because the Oswald stuff in Moscow is kind of, was it Moscow or was he in a different city?
No, he does go to the USSR at one point.
Yeah.
And then he comes back. Yeah, and then he goes to Mexico City.
We have documents from the KGB after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Where the KGB was awfully curious about who this guy is, and they were trying to figure out who he was. And they were like, is he just a malcontent from America? Or they were trying to figure out if he was a spy. There's documents on that too.
Yes.
That is, just interesting as well.
100%. And the other part of the narrative is, do you really think the government is competent enough? And that's one of those things that bothers me, because yes, the Department of Agriculture is extremely inefficient. When you go there, it's just rows of desks of people doing something, I don't know, writing checks, doing insurance evaluations, something like that, right?
We now know they aren't actually writing checks. It's just a computer that's just sending money wherever.
Yeah, right. Without any tag on what it accomplishes.
Yeah, like those, the magic computers or something Elon called them? There's 13 of them or something?
There are.
Yeah.
So that's the Department of Agriculture, but that's a very different department than the intelligence
agency. Well, you can look at the incredible inefficiency. You can look at incredible inefficiency examples, but then you also have that the CIA at this time was doing multiple operations over and over and over again to try to kill Fidel Castro. You say, they didn't accomplish it, so therefore...
They're
not any good at their job. Well, we're also overthrowing governments all over Central and South America. Well, we're also planning coups all over Central Europe and Southern Europe. Come on. There's many successful operations too. So you can't just go on this it's impossible because the government's inefficient and incompetent. Well, actually, no, they're quite competent when it comes to assassinating people and overthrowing governments.
Yeah.
Well, and it's like we had talked about I brought the Underhill memo forward on last episode, where he was the guy that shot himself in the back of the head, curiously, 6 months after.
It's pretty easy to do.
He has
with your
this,
left hand.
Yeah.
When you're right-handed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to shoot in front of you with a left hand, much less.
Yeah.
But his claims that he was putting forward is that there's a very specific clique within the CIA that got Kennedy. That's what he was claiming before he ended his own life, we'll say. but his thesis there has always been kind of it's much more about the clique that exists. Is there's probably a lot of these conspiracy theories, it's always the mob did it, the CIA did it, Mossad did it, or whatever. And my hunch tells me that there's probably a transnational clique that exists, that there's probably truth in all of those aspects. It's probably not very specifically yes, the head of the CIA made the order. That's not what it's going to be. Or the head of Mossad made that's not what it's going to be. It's going to be that there's cliques that exist, and they transcend national boundaries, and they work with organized crime and things like that. It's probably more so something to that effect.
Sure.
So do you really think the government is competent enough? It's You're not looking through the right lens with that. Right. That's not what it is. It's not even just the CIA did it. That's not correct. Well,
it's your mental model of government that you're applying to a specific circumstance. And that's a very dangerous thing to do, right? Because you're taking the overall picture and you're applying it to a particular picture. That level of resolution change is government competent? It's, are these people competent?
Right.
And what we're talking about are people who repeatedly overthrew governments and assassinated people leading up to this moment.
Yeah.
When you look at the particular individuals we're talking about, Richard Helms, Alan Dulles, Angleton, all these guys.
So I guess my question is, and maybe a question that the audience might be asking, if they're not as knowledgeable about sort of the geopolitical goings on around the JFK assassination, is why would these groups or cliques within the intelligence agencies of various countries want to assassinate the president?
So that's actually kind of what I prepared for today, was a lot of the understanding the relationships that JFK had with these different entities. And so one of the major things in a lot of the one of the major things in there is the Schlesinger memo. And he was Schlesinger. I hope I'm saying that.
How do you pronounce it?
Schlesinger?
Schlesinger? I've never known how to pronounce his name.
Say the hardest thing about podcasts is definitely names.
Say it one more time.
Schlesinger?
Okay, cool. I like it.
So he was JFK's special aide, and he wrote a memo June 10th, 1961, that was a 12-page report titled CIA Reorganization. And this was something that was made majorly unredacted in the drop. And for the context of this, it was written in the wake of the Bay of Pigs fiasco that had occurred. And it kind of covers JFK's frustrations with the CIA. You know, like RFK would always talk about how his uncle would say, we're going to smash the CIA into a million pieces, all this stuff. Yeah. And this kind of lays out the frustrations that he had. So part of the unredacted stuff here is the CIA overestimated the success chance. And this is unredacted, where it actually gives a number. They were stating that 80% of Cuban militia would defect in the Bay of Pigs. Like, they were just outright saying that to JFK, and JFK felt like he was lied to in the aftermath.
Yeah.
Because of it. Kennedy then proposed a plan where he would split the CIA into two different groups. One was intelligence gathering and one was covert ops, and appoint a civilian overseer to undercut the CIA director. Mm. So it's just basically like, we need, the CIA director has way too much power, and he has these two core roles of the CIA all together, and like, those need to be split apart.
And one part of that to understand the history is that the CIA was originally founded as an intelligence gathering organization, but then with a singular memo, they create the covert ops, where that singular memo, and I can't remember exactly what the citation is, but you can find it. It just says the CIA can do all these things on intelligence gathering, and it can do anything that the president directs them to do.
Right.
Right.
And we've gone over that in previous episodes as well, sort of highlighting where they got this unprecedented power from.
So what I'm saying that for is, it would be within the bounds of the president's power to then split the CIA in this way and reorganize them with this way, because it was created. These covert operations were created by that memo, as long as it was plausibly deniable, right? So that component of it could be broken out. It would be within his power to do.
Gotcha. So they must have sensed a real threat. The intelligence agencies sensed a real threat from the possibility that JFK might do this.
100%. Especially, just keep in mind, Alan Dulles was OSS, started the CIA. His brother is the Secretary of State. So would you fly into D.C. and you go to Dulles Airport? That's named after his brother.
John Foster Dulles.
Yeah. And so when he's serving multiple presidents over this time period, and this is the example of the deep state. That's the phenomenon we're talking about, of permanent bureaucracy that, regardless of who's president, wields the actual power, because you walk into the situation, they have all the institutional and relationships, powers to basically direct you as the actual democratically elected person.
To take you under their wing, say, hey, kid, you're new here. Let me show you the ropes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. And this happens relatively early in the president's, you know, relationship. He gets elected, and then Bay of Pigs happens not long after, and then he's firing Alan Dulles and trying to reorganize the CIA.
Yeah, and he specifically named in this memo from Schlesinger, he named Alan Dulles, where it is that he had way too much autonomy, and that he's stubborn resistance is what they called him.
Yeah.
Other interesting language in here was the CIA has grown into a state within a state, unanswerable to itself more than the elected government. Loyalty to its own ends over national interest.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
There are other details in the memo that I found kind of interesting, where it was talking about the CIA having a very bloated presence overseas. It was talking about large numbers of agents in places like Paris and Rome, and they were sidelining State Department diplomats. It was a concern that the CIA was monopolizing all of its contacts, hoarding them for itself and bypassing all official channels, and like hoarding the contacts away from the State Department.
Yeah. So imagine you're a diplomat in these areas, and rather than having the direct relationships that you want to direct American foreign policy, instead the CIA is doing that.
Mm-hmm. And no, so, it was something like the minimum that they had, and it even seemed like JFK was questioning how many agents they had in Paris, but it was like they had 74 agents basically controlling diplomatic relations in France, for instance. It's like stuff like that.
Yeah.
That is the State Department's role, right. is diplomatic relationships,
yeah. Yeah.
But the CIA was just controlling it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that started as the OSS, right, under Alan Dulles during World War II, mm-hmm. right? Like, he sort of established this autonomy. He wanted this autonomy. He wanted to be in Europe to be able to, you know, create his own sphere of influence and control communications and news that made it back to Washington.
And that's what I think. He didn't run the OSS, to be clear. He was just OSS officer.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was OSS officer. First, he was a corporate lawyer. World War II happens. He joins the OSS. And then, you know, and then the stuff, especially if you read Devil's Chessboard, the things that he did in Europe are quite sketchy as a corporate lawyer and then later as OSS.
Like withholding information from the State Department and the president mm-hmm. on what's going on in Europe.
And assisting American bankers in financing the Third Reich.
Yeah.
Right. And then
really good guy.
Very
just
close.
Good guy.
And being very close to ex-Nazis and helping cover them. And, you know, and that's Operation Paperclip. We know there's a difference. Operation Northwoods and Operation Paperclip. We did that wrong last podcast.
Did I say Paperclip? Last
and then time? And then I was like, I know that's wrong. But then I just
yeah,
went,
yeah,
like,
no, yeah, Paperclip is the Nazi one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. I meant Northwoods.
Yeah.
And if I said that last
and
time.
And the focus of that is usually on Nazi scientists, but it was also lots of other Nazi businessmen, bankers, all that kind of stuff to keep them from getting caught up in the Nuremberg trials. A lot of these ex-OSS officers that were of the Dallas sort, they wound up, you know, covering for them and helping them diplomatically. So, yeah, very sketchy guy.
There was one final tidbit that I found interesting in the Schlesinger memo. I'll get that. I don't know if I'm saying it right.
it works for me.
Schlesinger.
It mentions, it specifically calls out a training camp in Virginia where reckless improvisation is the norm.
Interesting.
And it doesn't name what the camp is, but people speculate that that's Camp Peary, which is known as the Farm, which is kind of a known entity within, you know, for anybody that's
CIA facility.
Knows, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like an odd little tidbit to be in there, but it does show that the JFK inner circle had this concern about, let's say, the cowboy culture that was going on with this reckless abandon that they seemed to be operating with.
Do we have any examples of this reckless improvisation that he references? Like, what is he referring
to? Not specifically, but like, I think you can kind of have my, like, they're kind of going off on their own. Like it symbolizes kind of this roguish nature that exists within them, where it's like they're very, and the executive JFK is very concerned about how like little control they have over this entity, right?
And this is interesting because this seems to still be a problem today, like very much a problem today, as we see with like the Hunter Biden laptop and all these intelligence officials signing the letter saying it's Russian disinformation. Obviously, like, nothing has changed. The relevance here is this was a problem then. It's still very much a problem now, probably even much worse, because they've had, you know, 60 years to continue operating in relative autonomy and secret, and oftentimes not under the control of or even in the interests of the president or the United States.
Well, and that's the thing is, if you look back at the Underhill memo that I covered last podcast, the guy who shot himself in the head with his non-dominant hand, apparently, 6 months after the assassination, is when he fled the day after and he went to his friends. He was talking about how there was a very specific clique who was very well connected with organized crime, narcotics running, gun running.
Yep.
So you're like this is what we're talking about here. Like, these are the cowboy elements of the CIA that's kind of the picture to be painted there, right?
Yeah. So a typical explanation is the OSS got to do what it wanted to do with very little oversight because you're fighting World War II, right?
Sure.
So afterwards, they say, okay, we need to keep this going so that we can keep communism from spreading all over the world. Eisenhower signs the memo. The memo then becomes basically the basis of the CIA's covert operations. And then these people blow that up into an international, you know, control everything, try to control every single democracy on the planet sort of operation. So once you're doing that, that was never official U.S. government policy, but becomes the national security policy, endorsed by the president, but also kind of run without the president's real knowledge and how it's actually being executed, because it itself is based upon the idea of need to know and plausible deniability. As long as it's plausible deniable, the CIA can do it if it's directed by the president. That's how it's worded.
And when you say plausibly deniable, you mean the administration doesn't know about it.
Well, it means we can lie about it, with some amount of lack of accountability.
Mm.
Right. This seems like that way that the democratic elements can say, well, I didn't know about that.
Right. It's unbeknownst to the oversight, you know, the elected officials that should be sort of overseeing the CIA.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, a recipe for disaster. So, and one of the other things I also dropped is a lot about James Jesus Angleton. Now, he was the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA. Counterintelligence, just to remind everybody, is your efforts to catch the spies that are spying on you, right? So, they are counterintelligence. Now, that's typically, that's also a role conducted by the FBI. COINTELPRO is an example of that program. This is the CIA's operation of that. And this guy actually would go on to conduct Operation Chaos as a part of counterintelligence. we had to get into Operation Chaos.
Yeah, so why don't we go into Operation Chaos just a little bit to overview for the audience?
Yeah, just basically conceptualize it as for the peace movement and for a lot of the nationalist movement that was happening at this time. Think the Black Panthers, think like the Students for Democratic Society and the Weathermen and all that kind of stuff that was causing a lot of actual internal violence and discontent, was a spying program on them. And then a agent provocateur program with them to undermine their case and basically make them less effective.
So basically they were infiltrating these groups and then trying to create chaos from them to undermine their political power.
Mm-hmm. Especially the anti-war movement.
Sure.
Right. So, yeah. So what happened this week was new releases, 113-page, fully unredacted 1975 Senate Select Committee to study government operations with respect to intelligence activities, top secret document.
That is a long title.
Yeah. Yeah. So what it does, and just to boil it down with the lowest level of resolution, is Angleton, it kind of documents his relationship in understanding who Oswald was. As someone who is a former Marines intelligence officer that goes to the USSR and then comes back, well, he had a large dossier on Oswald himself. And what it suspects and what it really confirms is a long-time suspicion that Oswald was recruited by the CIA as an intelligence asset. The question is why? Was it to surveil him, right? Was that why? It was like you create the relationship that's overt to him. And there is some evidence, like, for example, when he was arrested in New Orleans for passing out pro-Castro literature, he was basically, you know, he asked for, and in his, like, you get a phone call to talk to the FBI so that he could tell them that he was intelligence.
Oh,
right,
interesting.
And that's some of that suspicion. Not all that's grounded in like what we actually really know, but that's like the theory, right? Was it like to create that relationship as an agent provocateur to undermine the pro-Castro people, to undermine the like an Operation Chaos type of way, like a proto Operation Chaos effort, to lead the pro-communist organizations into making errors, right? Mm-hmm. That way you create forced errors that are unforced errors that then they can exploit in messaging to prevent a communist takeover of the United States.
Agent provocateurs.
Yeah, and undermine the anti-Castro efforts of the deep state, like what they want. They wanted to take Cuba back. Like the entire effort in this time was using these Cuban exiles to harass Cuba in low-level raids and low-level like terrorist activities, and then to eventually build up to something like the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
Right. And so if was it that they were just spying on him because they were worrying about being a Russian asset, or were they doing it to recruit him in as an agent provocateur? That's the question.
Hmm. Which do you think?
I think the latter. Because there's so much strangeness, right? So he like cuts through all these things. He goes from the USSR to the America without really being stopped or really being, you know, and then why don't we have what that intelligence dossier is? It's not in the documents so far that we've been able to find. So what did they actually know about Oswald? That seems very relevant, you know.
Pretty relevant.
Was it just incompetence? Right. That was what Piers Morgan would beg, like, it was just incompetence. Like they just didn't think he was capable of it. That sort of
thing.
Speaking
of assets.
He goes to Mexico, talks to multiple embassies. There's some sketchiness there too. There's some weird stuff with that. And then returns back to the United States and never gets stopped again. Right? Yeah. Like very strange.
Yeah.
But it's so similar to like you had brought up Ryan Routh, Joe. It's like the vibe is so similar.
It is quite similar.
I even remember when that second assassination attempt happened. I remember being like, it's so Oswald.
Totally.
It feels so Oswald.
Totally.
Yeah.
A lot of parallels.
Yeah. And what's weird is that guy is still alive. He's incarcerated someplace.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, why haven't we got anything else from that story?
Well, Jack Ruby's going to get on it.
So. Yeah.
They're working it out.
Yeah. So, and the other thing of this that was reported in the Devil's Chessboard and in the Secret History of the CIA from 2001 was Angleton's deathbed confession, which is interesting. And this wasn't part of the documents, but I think it's really relevant when you see Angleton come up in these documents. Is at the very end of his life, and I want to read it because I think it's very insightful. Fundamentally, the founding fathers of U.S. intelligence were liars. The better you lied and the more you betrayed, the more likely you were to be promoted. These people attracted and promoted each other. Outside of their duplicity, the only thing that they had in common was a desire for absolute power. I did things that, in looking back on my life, I regret. But I was part of it and loved being in it. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Camille Offey, and Frank Wisner, each of those are major players, were the grandmasters. If you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them there soon. I had not been serving God after all when I followed Alan Dulles. I had been on a satanic quest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez.
That's pretty heavy.
It goes into the cliquey nature of it too. Mm. It's like you have this cliquey nature of these people.
A small group of very powerful people who are interconnected globally through international corporations and the mafia to major players in power.
That sounds like a conspiracy theory. That can't be true.
Yeah. But that's how the CIA is designed.
Yeah. Like
that's what they exist to do, right? So people don't want to look at that because it's gross and you get this sense of like people in a black room with like giant pyramid heads or something like that. But no, it's actually just guys without a monocle, but smoking cigars and drinking whiskey and talking about how they're going to overthrow the government of Italy.
I mean, let's be fair. There could have been some monocles present, but to
this
the
would
point,
be a late
I don't,
monocle.
Yeah, I don't think this was, it was in fashion then.
They had horn rim glasses at this point.
Just for the vibe though. Just for the vibe. There's like, you know what? I'm just going to break out my grandpa's monocle.
But they're probably wearing suits though.
That's true.
Yeah.
Speaking of conspiracy theory, wasn't that term coined around this time of the JFK assassination?
Yeah. So what was it? There was a intelligence document that actually advocates for the use of conspiracy theory as a moniker for the people who are questioning the JFK assassination. Like that was
as a way to subvert it. Yeah.
As a way to
specifically
make them,
around the JFK assassination is when it became into use.
Yeah. To make them seem quackish forever considering that there was another theory.
Yeah. Well, and also if you think about it at the time, like there was a lot of big JFK investigators that were looking into it and they were getting all these big interviews at the time in the late 60s. I had mentioned also going back to the Underhill report of the DA in New Orleans was kind of becoming well known and he was talking about this at the time. So like it was kind of the popular thing to do in media was to bring these people on because people were curious. So mm-hmm. You have to undermine that.
Oh, right? For sure.
Like that's mm-hmm. that's a really important psyop to do.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. First of many. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the first, but one of many. Interesting. So where does it go from here?
So one of the interesting parts that is a major dialogue that happened this week, thank you Candace Owens and others, is the way that these a lot of the things that were censored that we already had access to were censored specifically because they had connections to Israel and Israeli mm-hmm. intelligence. And listen, for the Angleton part, is there's a substantial amount of the documents are related to, as in this 113 page document to the long name committee, was about the shift in Israeli-American intelligence cooperation, where Israeli-American intelligence cooperation was relatively combative and partially because of Angleton and others began to become more collaborative at the same time as the overt State Department policy was still quite hostile, specifically related around nuclear weapons and nuclear power for Israel.
Hmm. Interesting. So explain that a little bit. What was the contention there?
Well, so in part with the unredacted side, so for a long time in what files we did have, there was always like these lines where it's just like, okay, a few words are blocked out and it's like blah, 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 blah. And it's like, and then people would kind of guess, they're like, they're probably talking about some intelligence agency or something. Maybe it's Israeli intelligence. It's unredacted. It says Israeli intelligence in it, yeah. Right? And there's also interesting lines here where we're talking about one line that stuck out to me was new backers have emerged. Jews with plenty of money intent on taking care of Kennedy. But those are in documents with not much context. It's talking about in memos where it's talking about Cuban exiles and Southern segregationists and stuff like that. So, but it's in one of these areas where it's like we're missing pages still, and maybe these get figured out as because we only have one third of the document so far. Not everything's been digitized yet, but it suggests that there were like Jewish elites that were funding various groups that the CIA was tracking at the time. Like a lot of the things with Israeli intelligence and Jewish funding, it's not necessarily talking about the Kennedy assassination itself. It's talking about groups the CIA was tracking at the time, mm-hmm. Which then kind of goes into, I think people need to understand the relationship that Kennedy had with his policy in regards to Israel, because it's very different than our current policy towards Israel. Eisenhower and Kennedy both were kind of skeptical of the, we just have to have this one greatest ally in the Middle East. They were much more of a fan of like, let's be friends with everybody in the Middle East and let's have like strong alliances everywhere. Let's not like pick a favorite.
Yeah.
That was the Eisenhower JFK approach. So we'll get into the Ben-Gurion. So Ben-Gurion, former prime minister of Israel, him and JFK butt heads over the nuclear program in Israel a lot. Ben-Gurion said that their nuclear program was only going to be for peaceful purposes, and JFK didn't buy that. It was like, we're just going to nuclear energy, all this stuff, right? This is kind of the thing that's going on.
Maybe some defensive weapons?
Well, no weapons. So like, so this is where it gets kind of interesting, is JFK's stance upon taking office was non-proliferation across the whole Middle East. He wanted to make sure nobody in the Middle East had nukes, including Israel. And because he thought that some sort of a nuclear arms race would destabilize the region.
Yeah.
Right.
I could see that.
So
Ben-Gurion committed to allowing the U.S. inspectors to come in every few months into their major facility. I forget what it was called. There's a name for it. But when the inspectors came through, they refused to show them specific rooms.
Interesting.
There's like, no,
nothing
you can't go in those rooms.
About that.
You can't go in those rooms. You can see everything on the facility except for those areas. Those areas are off limits. So JFK was like, if you're not going to give us full transparency, I'm cutting off your $80 million in aid. So that's one area. Another area was what was going on domestically with it. There's a group called the American Zionist Council. This is the precursor to AIPAC.
Gotcha.
And Kennedy was trying to push them to register under FARA, Foreign Agency Registration Acts, Foreign Agent Registration Act. Mm-hmm. So it's basically like you have to... You know, like if you're getting funding or you're promoting the views of some foreign country, that has to be registered if you're going to be lobbying to the government, if you're going to be doing all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So the American Zionist Council was flushed with cash directly funneled from the Jewish Agency in Israel. It's actually the name of it. It's called the Jewish Agency. it's not like
you're not describing that. Though. That's how they describe themselves.
That is what it's called. And this agency is they promote Jewish immigration, Jewish settlement in the region, Jewish outreach. This is kind of their USAID in a sense. It's kind of like their international development program.
Soft power projection.
Yep. And they're getting direct funneling into the American Zionist Council. And so it's like, think of it as like the ideological and logistical arm of Zionism as like the ideology itself. Right. And then, so the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Attorney General, which was RFK, they exposed that this money was being routed into US groups here. And it's not just like Zionist groups. It's just, they were funneling money into US groups. So RFK put out these demands on them that was like, yo, you got to stop. You have to disclose this. There's even threats of arrests that are coming. It's just like we might have to stave off this problem because of rest of like this is a big problem here. So kind of understanding all of that context. Now, in hindsight, now that we have information, let's go back to the nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, historians are pretty clearly believe that the first nuclear weapons that Israel had developed was in 1966. And it seems like JFK was right to be like, it seems like what was in those rooms that we weren't allowed to see was specifically what the inspectors were supposed to find. Right.
Very interesting.
Also, we have documents suggesting that the Israelis had made secret deals for plutonium with France in order to develop these things. Right. And also in the JFK files that were dropped in 2016 via Trump before that were like heavily redacted, what we came to find was LBJ did get an intelligence brief understanding that Israel, in fact, had nuclear weapons. And he just decided, nah, I need the Jewish vote.
So I'm not going to do anything with this information.
Yep. And then going to Nixon next. Nixon implements the don't ask, don't tell policy with the Israel nuclear program, which is not about gays.
Yeah,
it's not about gays. It's not about gays. It's about nukes.
Wild. Right?
So like, that's kind of like the overall context of how the JFK relationship was, because like Eisenhower and JFK were kind of like Israel skeptics, not skeptics per se, but it's just like, we want to be friends with everyone in the Middle East. We want to have stable relationships everywhere. Then LBJ comes in and it's like, boom, everything changes. Our entire Israel policy changes with LBJ at the time.
What is LBJ's relationship with the CIA and the other entities that might have been involved in the assassination?
Well, this is an interesting thing because Candace Owens had something on her content this week talking about this.
But the CIA connection a little bit weaker, but as far as for why, the question of motive, like why would LBJ switch so hard? LBJ as a figure is a realpolitik figure. At minimum, so like the strongest don't have to know anything and just look at a case is he's just responding to the incentives of what he was facing to be a popular president and be democratically elected.
Sure.
Right? But on the other side of that, it could also be that he himself had particular ties to the Jewish community, which is a very interesting thing that Candace got into this week that it, you know, had been rumored but I'd never seen as well documented as what she was.
Yeah. So I guess let's play that clip.
Post, we will pull this up in the Times of Israel, but his aunt, Jessie Hatcher, was a member of the Zionist organization. And it has been speculated, not by me, okay, but by Rabbi Shmuel Golden, that LBJ himself came from a maternal line of Jews. Now, his family dates back to the 1848ers, which were a bunch of communists who tried unsuccessfully to overthrow Germany. And then they all came to Texas and settled in Texas and Kansas and all throughout the United States, including the Pfizer family. But pulling this back up, this is the opinion of Rabbi Shmuel, who apparently looked into it. And this is a blog written by Richard Chassman on the Times of Israel. He writes, "You can bet the ranch that Bernie Sanders will not be elected as the first Jewish president, but he might be the second. Who was the first Jewish president? LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. I thank Rabbi Shmuel Golden for making me aware of this fascinating story." He's now quoting from an article by Morris Smith in the Five Towns Jewish Times. Lyndon Johnson's maternal ancestors, the Huffmans, apparently migrated to Frederick, Maryland from Germany sometime in the mid-18th century. Later, they moved to Bourbon, Kentucky, and eventually settled in Texas in the mid to late 19th century. The facts indicate that both of Lyndon Johnson's great-grandparents on the maternal side were Jewish. These were the grandparents of Lyndon's mother, Rebecca Baines. Their names were John S. Huffman and Mary Elizabeth Perrin. John Huffman's mother was Suzanne Ament, a common Jewish name. Perrin is also a common Jewish name. Huffman and Perrin had a daughter, Ruth Ament Huffman, who married Joseph Baines, and together they had a daughter, Rebecca Baines, Lyndon Johnson's mother. The line of Jewish mothers can be traced back 3 generations in Lyndon Johnson's family tree. There is little doubt that he was Jewish. Now, again,
stop it there.
Yeah. And so that doesn't say that he's Jewish, therefore he's a Zionist, but it definitely that the policy after the death of JFK was a heavy switch towards Zionism, as you were pointing out, Kyle. So like you're not, we don't have him on record saying, yeah, I'm Jewish and that's why I'm Zionist. But we do have 2 facts that are sitting there. And what is the correlation between these 2 facts?
Right?
How do we understand them?
Yeah. Interesting questions to be had with it, right?
Yeah. You can't ask questions.
Can't ask questions.
No questions.
Shapiro says no questions.
Yeah, no questions.
I think it's just important for the context of the backdrop. Because right now, kind of where we're at on the... Because like, we're still... Everything's still being pieced together. We don't have all the documents yet. We don't have... Like, there's going to be time needed for the historians to go through the documents, the internet sleuths, et cetera, right? But, there is an interesting thing there of, like, it's worth noting what are the things that were redacted in the past that we couldn't see. And now there's all of a sudden all these Israeli intelligence, Israeli funders, et cetera, that are in there. And that's always been one of the pieces of the conspiracy theory of like who have the motives here. And the reason for kind of laying out the FARA aspect with RFK and JFK and then also the nuclear program is like here are motives that could be had if that was one of the reasons. And if the American Zionist aspect of it really had all this power and they're continuing to kind of infiltrate ideologically and they were getting Israeli funding, like that was a piece of it. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee found that. Like those are important aspects for us to kind of have in the back of our minds for the knowledge.
And because the policy switches after, right? So the Zionist Council rebrands into AIPAC and they never have to register under FARA. Despite
they're a 501c3 now,
right? And it's American Israeli PAC. Israeli is a name for a nation, members of a nation that's not America, right? So like that never happening, and then the switch on these things is what a lot of people pointed to as far as motive. a potential motive, right? Because, but that's not enough to prove anything, Ben Shapiro. That's a motive, means, motive, and material evidence. So, did they have the means? Did they have a spy agency?
Yes.
Yeah. Did they have a motive? We're kind of detailing that now. What is the material evidence that they are involved? And to me, amongst the existing theories, alternative theories, you know, you basically have, you got the Warren Report, which is the main theory. That's like the standard government explanation, that it was a lone communist working without any foreign powers backing, right? You have the Israeli question that has been in the media this week. And they wanted him out of the way for nukes, and so that they could get the foreign policy relationship between America and Israel right. And then you have a third one, which is that the CIA intelligence deep state faction working with Cuban exiles did so with the motive to not end the Cold War early, to keep the Cold War going. I think the latter half, the third one, has the most amount of current compliant material evidence when you look at the totality. And the Zionist one has a strong means and motive, but the material evidence that ties it directly to the Kennedy assassination is relatively weak.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean, like you were saying, that the same group of people that Angleton's talking about weren't also related to the switch in Israeli relationships, right?
And influenced by Zionist ideology and stuff like
and
that.
And wanted, right, to keep the Cold War going. So it's a very good possibility that number two and number three are correlated, right? Yeah. And that's a multiple motive reason to make the switch and who controls the presidency.
Well, it's important to also realize what's going on in the Cold War aspect at the time, where it's only about a decade after kind of the switch of Israeli allegiance from the Soviets towards the West. Mm-hmm. Like in the beginnings, the original kind of ally of Israel was much more tied towards the Soviet Union, mm-hmm, than it was the West. Mm-hmm. There was some falling outs that were had. Stalin got very paranoid and started he forced Golda Meir to leave because she was the ambassador at the time to the Soviet Union. And there was a lot of undercutting that was happening and with like kind of Western ideology when it came to the state of Israel. And so like we're kind of in that time period where it's like only a decade has gone by at this point from then. So like that's always also important to have in the backdrop.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious because we teased it further up in the show.
Let's hold it. We got to hold it a little bit longer.
You got to hold it.
What the question is okay. Well, have we done enough on this? Like, what are the questions of those connections? Right. So, like, are we? I just want to know. What is the best case for Israeli, you know, actions being tied here, or are we just sitting at, Kyle, we have some indication that there was a switch here, but not enough to tie it to the event? Because I don't want to leave our viewers confused, right? Is it just, you know, we have a motive and that's it, and that's it, or is there more to it?
Well, my specific thoughts of where everything's pointing to is that there's like a transnational clique that has kind of both of those motives in mind, mm-hmm, and the Israeli motive I think is a very strong one to be had with those types of people that would have been involved at that time. Mm. And it's like, was it an official policy of Mossad to take out JFK? I don't know. That's not necessarily there, but there seems to be a lot of animosity towards JFK at that time where like the CIA, Israeli funding and organized crime. I think that there's like a Venn diagram that exists there and they all overlap with each other. Mm. Much more than like people want to kind of separate them. And I'm saying that there's like overlap that exists there within it.
Well, there's certainly correlated interest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Where there may have been collaboration. There's something in it for everyone if JFK is taken out of the picture.
Yeah.
Right.
And like the organized crime aspect is like one piece too. Is like that's where you have the Jack Ruby stuff. That's like, you know, like all of these things are still muddy and we're still sifting through everything. Like, I don't think that there's any particular, like we have some hard hitting, this is it. Like, remember, we only have one third of the documents still so far.
Mm-hmm.
But like, even in all of those documents, I don't think we're going to ever have anything that's just like, yeah, we did it, guys. You know, there's never going to be any of that that comes out of it. A lot of this is requiring the pieces to be put together and coming up with the best theory. But then the most important aspect of it to me is people are kind of seeing how the sausage is made with intelligence, mm-hmm, right, as a whole, like in the global intelligence community and how these things work.
Yeah.
And some of the other things that have come out is the degree to which turf wars were a big part of this, like the FBI getting pissed off at the CIA and vice versa about domain. And this totally makes sense, right? Going all the way up to 9/11, they're still fighting over turf wars and not telling each other what's going on. And then we created the Homeland Security Department and all that kind of stuff to try to centralize all that. And we create the DNI. We do all these things to try to get these rival intelligence factions to actually work together for the interest of the American people. And they're still not.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also like also other important contexts. There's things like the USS Liberty at the time too. There's also I just gave some context on Israeli-American relations at the time, but like we also have the Israeli, you know, the USS Liberty attack. You know, like there's more things to be added to that. But also just like when we're talking about blackmail and spycraft, my understanding is that in the formation of the Israeli state, like there was a lot of blackmail that was going on with Rockefeller. There was a lot of blackmail that's like a lot of evidence suggests when we're talking about Robert Maxwell around this time in the UK with his being a media tycoon. Like this is Ghislaine Maxwell's father, who the British government says was a Mossad spy. You put all those pieces together and like there's a lot of evidence that suggests the types of things that were happening at the time, right?
And this is the interesting part of the motive question is, if Alan Dulles was blackmailed by the Israelis because he was working during his time at the OSS and afterwards as the head of the CIA, working with a Project Paperclip-like way to hide American investment in the Third Reich, if they use that as blackmail, then you have a good reason beyond all the other reasons, like Alan Dulles' personal reasons to hate JFK for firing him after the Bay of Pigs. Alan Dulles' reasons for disliking him because of the rapprochement that he was approaching with Castro and Khrushchev after the Cuban Missile Crisis. If all of those things all line up, that's that Venn diagram coming together with, additionally, he's being instructed by people who have blackmail evidence that connect him to not funding the Nazis. Then you have all of the reasons to go to the most radical extreme, which is we are going to assassinate the president using a plausible, deniable, you know, faction that we've been training already that already hates him as well, the Cuban exiles.
Well, and also just to put in, because I had introduced then there what was going on in Britain at the time with Robert Maxwell, mm-hmm. who was like major owner of media conglomerates,
right.
pushing narratives in the UK. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the media narrative going on there was for British support in the creation of Israel mm-hmm. in 1948 in the war and mm-hmm. the support behind it, right? And then you have the British saying that he was a Mossad agent, mm. right? Like that type of stuff was also happening around these times, right? Mm. You know, like that's important kind of context to have of what Israeli spycraft looked like at the time,
right?
Right. Right. But it's not like, you know, like spycraft, like CIA does spycraft like that too. You know, MI6 does spycraft like that too. Like it's important for people to have that as a framework.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Let's get into the final piece.
The most deep,
the most important,
the most profound spycraft.
So what we had here is previously, this is what this document, if you're viewing, you can see that there's a redacted section on this page. And it's like the only thing that's redacted on this page. And then,
well, look at the top thing. What does the top thing say?
Domestic tests for agency research and development efforts.
And then number, you know, like letter E.
It says remote physiological measurements. And then it says, and then the next thing is a paragraph on personality structure of defectors study. And then here's the next study. So it's like a list of studies that are being being studied. And then we move over to the unredacted version. And what gets unredacted is trained birds. Birds have been trained and tested in the United States to carry small intelligence collecting packages such as audio surveillance devices, small cameras, and current measuring devices. Any data collected from unwitting domestic sources would have been used only for engineering purposes and then destroyed. So
right.
The CIA was training birds to be spies. So there's a major conspiracy online that has existed in the past called birds are fake. Birds aren't real.
And
they're
COVID,
actually government drones.
And COVID was a ploy to ground them all and change the batteries.
They might have been onto something. Yeah. that's all I'm saying.
Wow. All right. Well, I knew I shouldn't have trusted those flying bastards.
Yeah, I love it. So when we think about the Neo Bros and they're all just sitting in a room like, let's invade this country. Like, it's the same sort of vibe, right? It's like, well, what if we train the birds? You know, like,
can you imagine the board meeting? All right, hear me out. Hear me out. We got a lot of pigeons, right?
Too
what if we put cameras on them and microphones?
And then train them to follow a target? Like, how do you train a bird to follow a particular target?
Well, how do you train a bird to be a messenger?
Yeah, messenger pigeons, right? Or, you know, stuff like that.
It's just like, this one day you just have this bird that's like around you all the time, and he's got a, how do they attach the microphone or camera to the bird? Are they,
how do you attach the message?
It's a little harness.
A little harness on it? You think you'd notice the harness? Like, I saw a bird wearing a harness.
Not if it's disguised, camouflaged as feathers and stuff.
There you go. Yeah.
Disguised, I mean, do you really ever look that closely at birds, David? Are you a birder?
No, I'm not.
Maybe you should become one.
Yeah.
You might discover some things.
That bird's a government drone.
That bird blinked weird. What's that all about? Oh, it's taking pictures with its eyeballs. What if they just replace an eyeball with a camera?
Yeah, there you go.
There it is.
Why is there a flash coming from that bird?
Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you guys for this hard-hitting research and analysis. Something that our audience has come to expect from this this podcast, I think, is just the deep stuff, but the stuff that answers the questions that we have as honestly and fairly as we can, without overstepping, without going too far into speculation, unless we, of course, call it out ahead of time.
I do like to dubiously speculate sometimes.
Occasionally.
Yes.
Occasionally. But this one, I think there's going to be a lot of dubious speculation. So our role in this is going to be to try to flush out the BS from what is plausible. And of course, as you mentioned, we only have a third of the documents. There's going to be a lot more of this coming, so you can expect to hear more.
And a lot of people just need to understand the context of things that were happening at the time, because that's actually the thing that I think a lot of people miss. And that's why we went into, like, the JFK-Ben Gurion relationship with the nuclear program. It's like, people don't realize that was happening at the time because it was 60 years ago. But that's, like, important to understand the dynamics of how the CIA was talking about Israeli intelligence and things like that at the time.
And the current dynamic, there's a lot of people online who are just kind of abusing this too. They're just like, they've searched Israeli and Israel, and they're just like, well, this proves it, you know, like as if that was the smoking gun. And that's a lot of confirmation bias and a lot of just, like, you know, clickbait, you know, efforts to do the whole thing. But there's the opposite side of that is Ben Shapiro, right? Which is like, don't ask questions. Don't look at it. You know, this is an important question. And that's also ridiculous and false. And we need to navigate between those two. And
I wonder why Daily Wire is going under right now.
Yes. I think, was it Clint Russell that made the observation that it's very interesting that Daily Wire is going through some trouble right now, right after the USAID funding has been upset?
It's curious.
It's very curious.
It's very curious.
Very curious.
Some people are asking questions. Some people are asking. I would never ask questions.
Yeah, we don't ask questions on the show.
No, certainly not.
I would never ask those questions.
Well, we would like for you to tell us what you think. Which theory is the most plausible? Leave us a comment below. You can also leave us a comment on Spotify as well. So let us know your thoughts. And definitely tune into the SCIF. We've got a very fascinating conversation coming up right after this for members. If you're not a member, become one. You can go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how. And if you're watching on YouTube, there's a join button. You can just click that and select whichever plan works the best for you. We'd appreciate you for supporting the show, and we appreciate you for watching. For David Rand, for Kyle Mack, for Bennett, wherever the hell in the world he is, I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember...
Oh my God. That would have been so funny. David drove all the way here just to not be in the show. What do you think
of that angle, David? Perfect. Thank you. I'm just going to creep at the bottom here. Like a little... Just,